This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with constitutional scholar Steve Rohde about three significant Supreme Court decisions that are pending or just came down.
Are these cases an indication of the rapidly declining democracy in our country? Stay tuned. We also speak with Palestinian solidarity activist Felice Gelman about her new short video, The Right to Boycott.
The right to boycott is being challenged by the ultra-right forces in this country. So far, 37 states have passed laws against it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. The U.S. Supreme Court, securely under the control of a supermajority of six conservative Republican justices, three of whom were appointed by Donald Trump, continues to play a decisive role in undermining our constitutional democracy. This ominous trend continues based on three recent key cases, which we'll be talking about today. In one, the court on March 4th rejected a lower court ruling that Trump was ineligible to run for president. In April, the court will hear oral arguments on Trump's claim of absolute immunity from criminal liability. And recently, the justices heard argument over whether social media sites had a right to ban Trump and others under their content moderation standards. All of these cases arise from the insurrection on January 6th, 2021, when a mob of thousands stormed the U.S. Capitol to prevent Joe Biden from being certified as president. That day, and for many months before and after, Donald Trump attempted to interfere with the constitutionally mandated process for the election of the President of the United States. Hanging in the balance of these three cases are some of the most momentous issues facing our democracy. Our guest on these important subjects is Steven Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a noted constitutional scholar and activist. He is the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, one of the founders and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and the author of American Words of Freedom and of Freedom of Assembly. Steve Rohde is also a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books and to Truthdig, and a leader in the national campaign to free the imprisoned investigative journalist, Julian Assange. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's such a pleasure to be with you, Maria and Michael. Thank you.
Last December, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, Donald Trump was disqualified from running for re-election as President of the United States. Please explain what that court decided and its reasons for disqualifying Trump.
The Colorado Supreme Court, backed by plentiful law review articles from across the political spectrum, Republicans, Democrats, constitutional scholars, the court held that under the 14th Amendment, Donald Trump was disqualified. It was a historically grounded opinion. It was grounded in the text of the Constitution and the history of the Constitution. After the Civil War, which I now call the first American insurrection, Congress passed the 14th Amendment in the Reconstruction Amendments, as they are called. In the case of the 14th Amendment, in Section 3, they provided that henceforth, no person shall be an officer of the United States or hold any office under the U.S. or under any state who previously took an oath to support the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or gave aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Section 3 also included a provision that Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove such disability. It was a straightforward clause, and it's been applied throughout American history, although rarely and never involving a president of the United States. Now, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which we'll be talking about, says that Congress shall have power to enforce, by appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article, unquote. I'll point out it doesn't say Congress must, it doesn't say Congress shall, and that'll come up later. So the Colorado Supreme Court did something that was straightforward, it was well documented, and that's the case that came before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Steve Rohde, on March 4th, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the Colorado decision. On its face, the decision was unanimous, but the court issued three different opinions. Can you explain what the court did and what we can learn from the different opinions?
This decision is a black mark on the U.S. Supreme Court and a stain on the U.S. Constitution. We can't be fooled by the fact that it was a unanimous opinion, and we'll discuss that in a moment. Five of the judges, part of the strong conservative majority, held that under the 14th Amendment, no state could disqualify a federal officer running, in this case, for election to the presidency. They threw in some history, some random quotes from some senators when the 14th Amendment was passed. They cited, of all things, a lower court opinion, which was not even a U.S. Supreme Court opinion, and they came to that conclusion. They swept aside the entire analysis of the Colorado Supreme Court, and they swept aside the very text of the Supreme Court, of the Constitution, I should say. And time permitting, we may talk about originalism and textualism. Here is the text of the Constitution. Now, what they did to get there is they tortured Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. They said that Congress must enact legislation to enforce Section 3. The problem is that Section 5 applies to the entire 14th Amendment. It applies in particular to Section 1, which guarantees due process of law and equal protection. It has never been held that Congress must pass new laws every time the law is to enforce due process and equal protection of the laws. Now, it was very unfortunate that the three liberal justices, Justice Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, concurred in the top-level decision reversing the Colorado Supreme Court. It's hard to explain why they did that. I think they were looking for uniformity. They were looking to introduce some quiet into the political atmosphere, but it was a huge mistake. And Amy Coney Barrett issued a separate concurrence. What they did there is the liberals did complain against the majority for overreaching. They could have decided the case that no state can disqualify a person running for office. That itself is a flawed analysis, but the liberals complained that instead the majority went far beyond that. They said that no federal officer could be disqualified in the federal system, so no one could sue in federal court over this issue. Or on January 6, the electors could not be rejected in Congress next year because Trump engaged in an insurrection. So this is a dark day for the court. They gave in to a Trumpian desire. It is possible that a Congress armed with a supermajority will in the future pass a law that would affect Donald Trump if he ever tries to run for president again. But the case, it shows arrogance on the part of the entire court. I think it'll go down in history, ironically, along with Bush v. Gore, involving a presidential election, as one of the most shameful decisions in the court's history.
In the criminal case pending against Trump in Washington, D.C., he and his lawyers are claiming that as a sitting president, he had absolute immunity from any criminal charges arising out of his official duties. But on February 6th, the D.C. Circuit Court rejected that argument. Now, the Supreme Court has set oral argument for the week of April 22nd. How do you interpret what the High Court is doing, and what does it portend for the future of the criminal prosecutions against Trump?
This is another case which plays out my theme today. The court has set that argument for April 25th specifically. This came up through the court system with lower court decisions that held that Donald Trump and no president has absolute immunity for crimes committed during their official conduct. The D.C. Circuit, not prone to be a liberal court or otherwise, it is viewed as a conservative court, wrote an extensive opinion explaining why a sitting president cannot and does not have immunity from crimes committed while in office. It was a clear opinion, and the Supreme Court had several options. It could simply have denied review. Many times where a lower court has written an extensive, fully briefed, and fully authenticated opinion, the Supreme Court lets it rest right there. They could have set oral argument immediately after the Court of Appeals made its decision in February. They didn't do that. They kicked the can down the road and set oral argument on the very immunity claim for April 25. It's likely this case will be argued, and it may not be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court until June, when many of its decisions come out. Jack Smith is trying to get this case to trial before then. I do expect the court, possibly by another unanimous opinion, to agree that no president has absolute immunity for crimes committed while in office. They may come to that with different theories and different opinions. I think there's a strong chance, certainly, that at least five justices and maybe nine justices will deny absolute immunity to Trump in this case. But what I fear is we have the tyranny of delay. We have the assistance in Trump's campaign to get him past the election in November, that we will not, even if they decide the case in June, that Jack Smith cannot mount and fully have heard and decided his case by November, in which case we will be going out to election with these charges pending, not to mention the other criminal charges elsewhere. To some extent, that will give the American people a decision. Do they want a lawbreaker and an insurrectionist elected in November, or do they want to reelect Joe Biden? The fear is that if by some circumstance of the Electoral College, the weighing in of third-party candidates, Trump gets elected, he can instruct his Justice Department to dismiss all criminal charges against himself, and we will be launched into a constitutional crisis like we've never seen. The court should have done this quickly. Jack Smith took the extraordinary step of asking the court months ago to rule on immunity, and they denied that request. They heard Bush v. Gore within days after the Florida courts heard that case. They heard the Pentagon Papers within weeks of that case coming to them. Instead, they are slow killing this case, and that's the part of this that poses such a danger to our democracy.
This is Attorney Michael Smith here at Law and Disorder Radio. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Maria Hall, and we're speaking with Steve Rohde, the constitutional scholar. Steve, following the insurrection on January 6th, several social media platforms suspended Trump's accounts. Twitter said, quote, "After close review of recent tweets from the @RealDonaldTrump account and the context around them, we have permanently suspended the account due to the risk of further incitement to violence," end quote. In response, Florida passed a law to prevent social media from banning public figures like Donald Trump. Texas passed a similar law preventing platforms from removing content based on viewpoint. But then, social media platforms challenged the laws, arguing that the laws violated their free speech laws, including the power not to publish content that they believed is dangerous. 2 weeks ago, on February 26, the U.S. Supreme Court heard 4 hours of oral argument on whether the social media companies have free speech rights, and if so, whether the Florida and Texas laws violate those rights. Steve Rohde, please tell us, if you will, how the dispute reached the Supreme Court. Who are the parties, and what issues did the justices agree to decide?
So let's set the stage here. It's very important to know that the First Amendment prevents government from censoring free speech, from writing laws that dictate what people can and cannot say. There are some exceptions to that, which we'll discuss on another occasion. But the First Amendment applies to government. Social media sites are private entities. They are private, such as newspapers and book publishers and others are private. Social media sites have set terms of service and community standards, which every user agrees to when they sign on. And under those community standards, social media sites decide if certain material is offensive, if certain material is incitement to crime. And that's what these sites did after January 6th. They made the lawful, constitutionally protected decision to remove Trump and other insurrectionists from their sites. And they had a lawful right to do that. Instead, Texas and Florida, under the control of Republican governors and Republican legislatures, passed laws. In Texas, they passed HB 20, which purports to prohibit large social media platforms from restricting, they call it censoring, speech based on the viewpoint of the speaker. One section prohibits viewpoint-based censorship, and another section requires platforms to disclose how they moderate and promote content and to publish, quote, acceptable use policies and maintain a complaint and appeal system. Florida, likewise, passed a law which prohibited deplatforming of political candidates and requiring disclosure of the reasons for the deplatforming. Now, in the case of those decisions, they went up through the courts. Eventually, the federal courts of appeal had split decisions, one upholding the law, one denying the law, and that came before the United States Supreme Court to argue those cases. And that's where the cases stand at the time of the oral argument.
Well, on February 26th, the Supreme Court heard those oral arguments, didn't they? 4 hours of them. Please summarize the key points made by each side.
Well, this was set against some really settled law about what private parties can do with their publications. One of the most important cases is a case called Miami Herald versus Tornillo, decided in 1974. There, a Florida law required newspapers to offer equal space to political candidates who wished to respond to election-related editorials or endorsements. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously struck down that law. It said Florida can't tell newspapers what to print on their pages. That's an editorial decision. The law would be an intrusion into the function of editors and the exercise of editorial control and judgment. There's a second case that was argued called Hurley versus Irish American Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Group of Boston. There was the classic St. Patrick's Day parade down the streets of Boston, but the court held that it was a private event, and the organizers of the St. Patrick's Day parade had the right to decide who would participate in the parade, what floats, what bands, what dignitaries, and what individuals. Now, sometimes the First Amendment is a bitter pill. In this case, I remember this decision coming out in 1995. It was very upsetting that the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously, again, with liberals and conservatives, would allow the exclusion of an LGBT group from a parade. But the question under the First Amendment is always the principle at stake. Could we force people to include speech that they disagree with in their own private publications? And that's what was argued before the court. The lawyers against the Texas and Florida laws pointed out that private parties every day make editorial decisions. Bookstores choose what books to sell and display. Museums, what art to display. Theaters, what plays and movies to show. Art galleries, what art to show. And concert halls, what music to display. If we go down the road that any state could pass a law dictating what content such facilities or publications or newspapers or magazines could publish, that's a very dangerous time. Therefore, the argument went in favor, by most accounts, to the First Amendment views in the case. I think the court has several options now when it considers the case.
Attorney Steve Rohde, what are the possible outcomes here? In other words, what would it mean if the court upheld the Florida and Texas laws? Or on the other hand, what would it mean if the laws were held unconstitutional?
Actually, the court has some options. Two of the justices, Justice Alito and Kagan, suggested that the factual record was incomplete, that perhaps they should remand the case to the lower courts. That, I don't think, will carry the day. I think this is a full record. I think all of the issues are fully briefed and argued, and I think it invites a decision by the highest court. There was some suggestion by Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson. They were concerned about the question of discrimination. And I believe that if this case is decided in terms of striking down the Texas and Florida laws, there may be concurring opinions in which those justices and others may say, we fully agree sites can publish viewpoints that they endorse and or criticize, but they cannot discriminate with their users on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity, or gender. We may see those justices who are very concerned about this in light of the famous wedding cake, a masterpiece wedding cake, which allowed private parties to discriminate against gay and lesbian couples. a case last term in which a website designer was allowed to discriminate over the objections of the liberal justices. I think they may take this occasion to reinforce that whatever the free speech rights are, that you cannot discriminate against your users on those grounds. Certainly, that's what I hope the court will decide.
Steve Rohde, this case highlights another issue, that is, how this Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Some believe it should be interpreted as the original framers intended it in the 18th century, whereas others believe the Constitution is a living document that must adapt to our ever-changing world. Where do the justices stand, and how might their leanings impact future decisions?
This is a very important issue. This was the death knell to Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision a few years ago. There is a strong viewpoint which now prevails on the U.S. Supreme Court, which used to be a minority viewpoint. It's been promoted by Justice Clarence Thomas, by Neil Gorsuch, and others have picked up and use it when they want. And that's this notion of originalism or original text or textualism. It's a notion developed by Robert Bork and other conservatives through the Federalist Society and elsewhere that tries to freeze the U.S. Constitution in the 18th century, that tries to hold accountable any constitutional claim and to reject such a claim if it doesn't fit within the minds and values of the founders who wrote the Constitution and ratified it. As my biased description shows, I think it is an outmoded theory, and it is contrasted with the notion of the Constitution as a living document, that the document has broad terms, freedom of speech, due process, equal protection of the law, and that it grows and meets ever new invasions of those rights. There was no television at the time the First Amendment was adopted. There was no internet, but no one would pause and reject free speech for the internet and other forms of technology, television and radio that came later. Justice William Brennan Jr., my favorite justice, who I was privileged to meet in his chambers before he died, he nailed originalism. He said it is arrogance cloaked as humility. It's these conservative justices wringing their hands. Oh, we're sorry we can't vote in favor of civil rights and civil liberties. We're bound by the intent of the framers. That's the humility part, but it's all arrogance because they are furthering their own values. We're seeing this in this Supreme Court, but when it works for them, they will abandon originalism to come to their predetermined political decision to advance the agenda of the presidents who appointed them. And for three of them, that's Donald Trump. We're seeing that in this court. They cast aside originalism when they dealt with the 14th Amendment. We as voters and as participants in this democracy must be ever alert to the nature of this supermajority on the Supreme Court. And eventually, someone said, it's the Supreme Court, stupid. Presidents nominate Supreme Court justices and Senates confirm them. That's what's going to happen. There will be vacancies in the next presidential term and in future terms, and it is the President of the United States that will nominate those justices. And that should alert and wake up everybody who cares about our constitutional democracy.
Well, Steve Rohde, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time. But this has been a real privilege for Maria and I to be able to interview such an eloquent spokesperson for democracy. And we're really grateful that you're on the show. We were going to want you back. I don't think that the next few months are going to be great for us. And we need to talk to somebody like you about what's going to happen. Meanwhile, Steve Rohde, you take it easy.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The First Amendment gives citizens the right to boycott, as well as the right to free speech and assembly and the separation of church and state. The right to boycott is under attack by right-wing anti-democratic forces. Anti-boycott bills have been passed in 37 states so far. The main organization behind canceling our constitutional right to boycott Israel for its horrific crimes against Palestinians is the American Legislative Exchange Committee, called ALEC. It is a well-funded right-wing outfit with considerable power. Today, we speak with leading Palestinian solidarity activist Felice Gelman. She helped produce and direct the 5-minute video just out called The Right to Boycott. It's a strategic tactic to oppose Israeli crimes against Palestinians. Boycott started with the Boston Tea Party here in America. Then the Montgomery bus boycott set off the civil rights movement in the South. The Great Boycott supported Cesar Chavez and the farm workers in California, and of course the famous boycott against apartheid South Africa. The necessity of pushing back against Israel's genocidal practices has never been more evident. Our guest today, Felice Gelman, is a coordinator of the Freedom to Boycott New York State Coalition, which has worked for a decade to defeat legislation penalizing boycotts in New York State, and recently released a short video, The Right to Boycott. She's a board member of the Friends of the Jenin Freedom Theater, which supports the Freedom Theater in the West Bank of the occupied Palestinian territories. She was the co-producer of the first full-length documentary film directed by Palestinian filmmakers in Gaza. It's called Where Should the Birds Fly? Felice Gelman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you.
Well, we so admire your good work in support of Palestinians, Felice. And recently you've made a 5-minute, really smashing video called The Right to Boycott. Could you please tell us about it?
Sure. I'm one of the coordinators of the New York State Right to Boycott Coalition, which has been around for almost 10 years, trying to make sure that New York State did not try to penalize the boycott of Israel. Unfortunately, the governor, we were able to stop legislation, but unfortunately the governor under Andrew Cuomo issued an executive order. But I think we have been pretty effective. And we started to see, when we saw the movie Boycott that was done by Just Vision, we realized how big this anti-boycott legislation has gotten and how important it is. And we felt that we needed an educational tool that all kinds of people could look at quickly. The Just Vision movie is great, but it's a feature-length documentary. And we needed something that we could get to people and they could get the picture very, very quickly. And then if they want to know more, they can go on and look at other resources, including that film. So that was what was behind it. And the coordinators of the coalition worked to put that film together, and we launched it at the end of February. So we're really pleased with how many people have seen it so far, but we really want to spread the word, because the effort of legislators to outlaw boycott as a method of protest, or not outlaw it, but penalize it as a method of protest, started with people using opposition to the BDS movement and the boycott of Israel. but it has now spread to people, to trying to penalize people who boycott fossil fuels, trying to penalize people who boycott gun manufacturers. So basically trying to undermine our entire First Amendment right to protest. So that's the reason we made the film.
Well, speaking of the right to protest and the First Amendment, what are the types of rights and activities that are supposed to be protected by the First Amendment?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Well, I mean, the First Amendment protects the right to petition the government for the redress of grievance, the right to assemble, the right to freedom of religion, and the right to freedom of speech. Those are the basic rights of a democracy that the First Amendment protects. And the Supreme Court in 1982, in a case called NAACP versus Claiborne, ruled that boycott was, and in fact, was a kind of speech which was protected by the First Amendment and should not be abridged. So that's the First Amendment. It's the most important thing in any kind of for any system to even imagine that it is a democratic system.
Felice Gelman, boycotting has a long history in our country, going all the way back to the Boston Tea Party, civil rights movement, the support of the people fighting against the apartheid state in South Africa. Can you talk about that long history, please?
Sure, sure. I mean, of course, in this country, the first boycott was, in fact, the Boston Tea Party, when people basically boycotted the English imported tea because they objected to the tax that was being levied upon it and the other measures that the British colonial rulers had taken against the settlers here. But the name actually comes out of a boycott that was in support of Irish independence. But it's been very important in this country. Actually, I have to say, I took my first political action to participate in a boycott. The civil rights movement had called for a boycott of Woolworth's chains because in the South, they segregated their lunch counters. And I, as a preteen, but it was found in Ossining carrying signs saying boycott Woolworth's. So I'm intimately involved with that. But I mean, I may be the most stunning victory for the boycott, I think, as a weapon, was the boycott of grapes in order to support the efforts of the United Farm Workers to unionize farm workers. And people refused to buy grapes and on such a massive scale that the farms were eventually forced to give in. But boycott has won many, many issues. And in fact, state governments have initiated boycotts. So when some southern states passed laws that were seen as discriminating against LGBTQ community, some states said they would refuse to have any events or have anything, any public events or anything else in those states. That's a boycott. So it's been used very broadly, both by individuals and, as I say, by states. I think the boycott of South Africa was essential to ending the apartheid system there. So one of the things that Palestinians have called for, and now that we're close to 20 years since the Palestinian community, 170 Palestinian organizations called for the use of boycott, divestment, and sanctions to uphold the principle that Palestinians have the same human rights as everybody else and to protest Israel's occupation and colonizing of Palestinian land. So that was 20 years ago. It's a movement that the Israeli government has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to oppose, but it has still won important victories. Entertainers have boycotted performances in Israel. The sports teams have boycotted participation with Israeli teams to protest what the Israeli government has done. Companies have been called upon to stop doing business in Israel, which is part of the divestment movement. And they have, and they may not have announced that they have done it for the reason of boycott, but they have left the country because it's not because of the support for the BDS movement. So it's had a lot of victories.
Felice Gelman, in your movie, you say that ALEC, A-L-E-C, is behind the anti-boycott bills. What is ALEC?
ALEC is the legislative version of dark money in politics. ALEC is called the American Legislative Exchange. It's supported by all the major corporations, or almost all the major corporations in this country, and of course many other corporate entities. And it's what it does is it drafts legislation, model legislation, and then tries to get it passed state by state. So it's absolutely a top-down movement. It's very well funded. It supports the right wing agenda. It's anti-labor. It's been anti-civil rights. It's been, and it's opposed to the boycott of Israel. It's now turned its efforts even further. But if you take a look at legislation that has been passed that is anti-labor, for example, you will find that across many states, the wording and the intention of the legislation is identical. And the reason is because right-wing legislators particularly turn to ALEC to give them the bills that they should pass. So it's a really insidious organization that has undermined the independence of the state legislative process and brought corporate money to bear in a huge way.
You're a supporter of the Janine Freedom Theater. Where is that located, and what does it do? And what has been done by the Israelis to silence them?
Okay, well, this is a slightly a different topic, but it's very important. The Janine Freedom Theater is a cultural institution in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, so it's in the city of Janine. And Janine has long been a center of resistance to the Israeli occupation going back years. So the theater itself is the way that the director, the artistic director of the theater describes it. He says this is an international artistic and cultural organization located in the occupied West Bank of Palestine. And I think that's really true because its job has been to use art to resist the occupation and to take the stories and concerns of Palestinians around the world. So it's a theater that has performed in South America, it's performed in North Africa, it's performed across Europe. I'm probably missing some other places that it's been. So that's what the theater is, and it is in the Janine refugee camp, and it hosts the only acting school in the occupied West Bank. It's produced a number of actors who actually have performed in plays here off Broadway and elsewhere. So it's a incubator and curator of the Palestinian art and culture, and takes that both into the camp and around the world. But what is going on? I think that the story of the theater is the story of what is going on in the West Bank, which is that in Gaza we have a high-intensity war. In the West Bank we have a low-intensity war. But the same things are going on. These same things. The Israeli army is dropping bombs, in this case usually using drones, attacking the camp. I mean, at least three or four times a week, Israeli army comes into the Janine camp, which is a very densely populated area, wages some kind of an attack. They may bomb a house, They certainly arrest people. They send snipers in, at least five people who are associated with the theater, almost all of them children, have been killed by the Israeli army in the last year. And many other people in Jenin have been killed. What's going on is a war. You know, our government is trying to hide that by talking about settler violence. There is settler violence, and the settlers have been very aggressively trying to take over territory and kick Palestinians out in the West Bank. But how do they do that? They're supported by the army. The army, and the army is the settlers, because most of the people who are serving in the West Bank are settlers themselves. Our government is trying to hide that by saying we're going to sanction a few settlers and so forth. That's not the problem. The problem is that there's a war going on against Palestinians who have are not able to fight back. So in the theater itself, our general manager, Mustafa Shetta, was arrested and just taken out of his house, which was obviously terrifying for his family. And he's been held without any charges or any reason. And he's been held incommunicado for, he will be held until June at least. And they can decide to double up and continue to hold him. They have been holding the chairman of the board of the Freedom Theater for more than a year. Again, no charges, no trial. Incommunicado. And thousands of people, the Israelis, I just saw the number, right? The Israelis have arrested more than 7,400 people in the West Bank since the October war began. That's what's going on there. And the theater is, like everyone else, is facing this incredible situation. The army invaded the theater. They vandalized it. They did something which probably is really painful to people who are Jewish, which is they put graffiti all over the theater using Jewish symbols. So it's been a very difficult time. And it's just, as I say, part and parcel of everything else that's going on in the West Bank that nobody is really looking at.
Felice, if I might, could I ask you a personal question? How did you get involved in Palestine solidarity work?
Okay. My husband was born in Haifa. He describes himself as a Palestinian Jew because he was born in 1940, so he was born in Palestine. And we have a family in Israel, and have this, you know, spent many visits there. But when the Second Intifada started with Ariel Sharon's invasion of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Haram al-Sharif, my husband was so angry and at what was being done in the name of Jews and in the name of people like himself, that we decided we had to go to Palestine and really understand what was going on. We went to the West Bank and saw the settler violence, which was horrific in Hebron. We went to Budrus and saw their struggle against the apartheid wall being constructed on their land. We went to Jenin, which by the way, was a very difficult trip because the roads had all been closed to protect the Israeli settlements that had been built there. And we saw how the effort of the occupation was to isolate and control the Palestinian cities. And we saw, there was much more that we saw, but that was it. And we said, this is really, we can't just watch this. This is disaster. We can't watch it. Just watch it unfold. So that was really where it began. Since then, we've been involved with the Freedom Theater, and we've also been involved in other Palestine solidarity work. And this film was that the New York State Freedom to Boycott Coalition did was part of that. It's part of that. I hope everyone will watch it.
How can people watch the film, and how can people learn about the Janine Freedom Theater?
All right, let's see. I just want to say, to see the movie, which is on YouTube, you can go on your computer and search for it. You can search for it on YouTube by looking for The Right to Boycott 5-Minute Film, or you can do BIT.LY/right2 boycott, and that will get you where you want to be. How can people help support the Freedom Theater? Well, I think there are a number of things. One is, right now, at the end of March and the beginning of April, Ala Shahada, who is a graduate of the Freedom Theater and the founder of the Palestine Comedy Club, has many other accomplishments. He's appeared in productions in New York and so forth. He's coming from Janine, and we will be doing a tour with him. So people can write to us at friends@thefreedomtheater.org, and we will send them the information about it. That's one thing. They can go to the Freedom Theater's website, Google the Freedom Theater, and there's an opportunity to donate there. So those are two things. But I think that spreading the word about what is happening that's very important.
I'll say, Felice, we've come to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you, do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
Yes, I do. I want to say that what people can do is demand ceasefire. They can demand an end to military aid. They can pressure their politicians to stop standing against Palestinians and supporting Israel's occupation and genocide. That's what they can do, and it's now. They can do it now. So, Rima, thank you so much for having me on the show. That was great.
Well, Felice Gelman, thank you very much for being on the show, and thank you very much for the good work that you do. We'll check in with you later on. You take it easy.
Thank you so much, and you do great work. Thanks. Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.